Verna only incrementally became aware that she was awake. It was as dark with her eyes open as with them closed. She blinked, trying to ascertain if she really was conscious. Deciding that she really was awake, she called her Han in order to light a flame. It wouldn't come. She sank deeper into herself and pulled more power. Straining with all her might, she at last managed to light a small flame in her palm. There was a candle on the floor beside the pallet where she sat. She sent the flame into the candle wick, sagging with relief that she could see at last, without the monumental effort required to hold forth a flame with her Han. The room was bare except for the pallet, the candle, a small tray with bread, and a tin cup of water, and what looked to be a chamber pot against the far, plastered wall. Not too far. The room was not very big. There were no windows, only a heavy wooden door. Verna recognized the room. It was one of the rooms in the infirmary. What was she doing in the infirmary? Looking down, she realized she was naked. She turned to the side and saw her clothes in a pile. When she turned, she felt something at her throat. Reaching up tentatively, she groped at her neck. A Radahan. Her flesh went a-tingle. Dear Creator, she had a Radahan around her neck. Panic washed through her in a dizzying rush. She clawed at her neck, trying to get it off. She heard a cry coming from her own throat as she whimpered in terror while yanking frantically at the unyielding ring of metal. In horror, she realized what the boys felt to have this instrument of domination bound to them. How many times had she herself used a collar to make someone do as she wished? But only to help them, only in their best interest, only to help them. Did they feel the same helpless dread? She remembered with shame using the collar on Warren. "Dear Creator, forgive me," she cried. "I only wanted to do your work." Sniffling back the tears, she brought herself back under control. She had to figure out what was happening. She knew that this collar wasn't around her neck to help her, it was to control her. Verna fumbled at her hand. The prelate's ring was gone. Her heart sank. She had failed in her guardianship. She kissed the naked finger, beseeching strength. She pounded her fist against the door when the handle produced no movement. She summoned all her power, focusing it on the handle, trying to make the lever lift. It wouldn't budge. She lashed out at the hinges she knew to be on the other side. Furiously, she concentrated, applying her Han to the task. Tongues of light, green with mental bile, lashed at the door, licked through the cracks and flickered under the gap at the bottom. Verna cut the impotent flow of Han, remembering seeing Sister Simona trying the very same thing hour after hour with the same ineffectual results. The shield on the door couldn't be broken by one in a Radahan. She knew better than to waste her strength on useless effort. Simona might be crazy, but she was not. Verna slumped back down on the pallet. Her fists pounding against the door would not get her out. Her gift would not get her out. She was trapped. Why was she here? She looked down at her finger where the prelate's ring belonged. That was why. With a gasp, she remembered the real prelate. Anne had given her a mission and was depending on her to get the Sisters of the Light away before Jigang arrived. She dove for her clothes, searching frantically through them. Her Dakra was gone. That was probably why they had stripped her, to make sure she had no weapon. That was what had been done to Sister Simona for her own protection, to be sure she wouldn't hurt herself. They couldn't let a crazy woman have a deadly weapon. Her fingers found her belt. She yanked it from the pile of clothes and, fumbling along its length, found the bulge in the thickness of leather. Trembling with hope, Verna held the belt near the candle. She pulled open the false seam. There, nestled inside the secret pocket, was the journey book. She clutched the belt to her breast, thanking the Creator as she rocked on the pallet, holding her belt tight to her. She had at least this much. When she had finally calmed, she pulled her clothes close to the weak light and dressed, feeling better at least, not to be naked and helpless. She was no less helpless, but at least she didn't have to suffer the indignation of being a naked prisoner. She was beginning to feel the least little bit better. Verna didn't know how long she had been unconscious, but she realized she was ravenous. She devoured the crust of bread and gulped down the water. After her belly was at least partially satisfied, she turned her thoughts to how she had come to be in this room. Sister Leoma. She remembered Sister Leoma and three others waiting for her in her office. Sister Leoma was high up on her list of suspected Sisters of the Dark. Though she hadn't been put to a test, she had been a part of putting Verna in here. That was proof enough. It had been dark, and she hadn't seen the other three, but she had a list of suspects in her head. Phoebe and Dulcinea had let them in, against her orders. However, reluctantly, they had to be placed on the list, too. Verna started pacing the small room. She was beginning to get angry. How dare they think they could get away with this? They had gotten away with it. A scowl settled in. No, they hadn't. Anne had given her this responsibility, and she would live up to that faith. She would get the Sisters of the Light away from the palace. Brenna touched her fingers to her belt. She should send a message. Dare she, in here? What if she were caught? It could ruin everything. But she had to let Anne know what had happened. Her pacing halted abruptly. How was she going to tell Anne that she had failed, and that because of her all the Sisters of the Light were in mortal danger, and she had no way to do anything about it? Jagang was coming. She had to escape. With her in this prison, none of the Sisters would know to escape, and Jagang was going to have them all. Richard leaped from the horse as it skidded to a halt. He glanced down the road and saw the others far below galloping to catch him. He rubbed the horse's nose and then started to tie the reins to an iron lever on the drop gate mechanism. He glanced over the gears and levers and then tied the reins to the end of a gear shaft instead. The place he had at first started tying the reins was the release lever to the huge gate. A good yank, and the portcullis could come crashing down on the horse. Without waiting for the others, Richard started into the wizard's keep. He was furious that no one had awakened him. A light is burning in the windows of the keep for half the night, he thought, and no one has the nerve to wake the Lord Rawl and tell him. And then, not an hour before, he had seen the lightning and the bloom of light racing outward in an expanding ring through a clear sky, leaving in its wake a smoky layer of clouds. A thought coming to him, Richard paused before he went into the keep and turned to look down on the city. At the bottom of the keep road, other roads branched off, leading away from Adendrill. What if someone had been in the keep? What if they had taken something? He had better tell the soldiers to hold anyone trying to leave. As soon as the others reached the keep, he would send one back down to tell the soldiers to bring back anyone leaving and to seal the roads. Richard watched the people on the road. Most were coming into the city, not leaving. There were a few leaving, though. What looked to be a few families with handcarts. Some soldiers going out on a patrol, a couple of wagons with trade goods, and four horses close together, trotting past the people on foot. He would have them all stopped and checked. But checked for what? He could take a look at the people himself after the soldiers brought them back and maybe tell if they carried anything magic. Richard turned back toward the keep. He didn't have the time. He needed to find out what had been going on up here, and besides, how would he know if it were a thing of magic? It would be a waste of time better spent. He needed to get to work with Berdine and translate the journal, not paw through family's belongings. People were still leaving, not wanting to live under Daharan rule. Let them. He marched through the shields inside, knowing that the others would be blocked when they arrived. The five of them would be upset he hadn't waited for them. Well, maybe the next time they would wake him if they saw lights in the keep. Shrouded in his Mriswith cape, he made his way upward, toward where he had seen the lightning hit the keep. He avoided passageways that he could sense were dangerous, and found other routes that at least didn't raise the hair at the back of his neck. Several times he sensed Mriswith, but they didn't come near. In a wide room with four corridors leading from it, Richard stopped. Several doors stood closed. One had a trail of blood leading to it. He squatted and inspected the smeared trail of blood and determined that it was actually two trails, one leading into the room and one leading out. Richard flung open the Mriswith cape and drew his sword. The clear ring of steel echoed down the corridors. With the point of the blade, he pushed the door open. The room was empty, but it was far from ordinary. The wood floor was scorched. Sooty, jagged lines were seared into the stone, as if an enraged lightning storm had been trapped in the room. Most puzzling, though, was the stone block of the walls. Here and there, huge blocks of stone hung halfway from the wall, as if they had come near to toppling out of their place. The room looked like it had nearly come apart in an earthquake. There were blood splatters all over the floor, and to the side a big pool of it, but because of the fire that had blackened the floor it was all dry as dust and told him little. Richard followed the trail of blood from the room until it led to a door to the outer rampart. He stepped out into the cold air and immediately saw the splashes of blood spilled across the stone. It was recent, within the last day. Mriswith and parts of Mriswith littered the windswept rampart. Even though they were frozen now, they still stank. Against one wall, a good 5 feet up, was a huge splat of blood, and below it, on the ground, a dead Mriswith. Its scaled hide burst open. If the spray of blood had been on the ground instead of the wall, Richard would have thought it had fallen from the sky and been killed from the impact. His eyes gliding over the mess, Richard thought it looked like what was left when Gratch fought Mriswith. He shook his head in dismay, wondering what had happened. He followed a trail of blood to a notch in the crenellated wall and found blood staining the stone to each side. He stepped into the notch and peered over the edge. It was a dizzying sight. The stone blocks of the keep plunged nearly vertically, flaring slightly toward their foundation far below. and beneath that the stone of the mountain itself fell away for what looked to be several thousand feet. From the notch in the wall, a trail of blood ran down the face, disappearing in the distance below. There were several big splotches in the bloody trail. Something had gone over the edge, smacking the wall on the way down. He would have to send soldiers out to see what or who had gone over the edge. He ran a finger through different trails of blood at the edge. Most of it reeked of Mriswith. Some did not. Dear spirits, what had happened up here? Richard pressed his lips together as he shook his head. He drew the black Mriswith cape around himself and vanished as he pondered, thinking, too, for some reason, about Zed. He wished Zed were here with him. Chapter 42. This time, when Verna saw the little flap open at the bottom of the door, she was ready. She dove toward it, shoving the tray aside and putting her face against the floor, trying to see out. "Who's out there? Who is it? What's going on? Why am I being held here? Answer my questions!" She could see a woman's boots and the hem of a dress, probably a sister who cared for those in the infirmary. The woman straightened. "Please, I need another candle. This one's almost gone." She could hear the disinterested footfalls vanish back up the hall, and then the sound of the door and the big bolt being dropped into place as she ground her teeth and pounded her fist on the door. Verna finally slumped down on the pallet, comforting her hand. She had been pounding the door too often of late. Her frustration was overcoming her sense, she knew. In the windowless room, she had no idea anymore if it was day or night. She assumed that they brought her food in the day and so tried to keep track of time in that way. But sometimes it seemed they brought food only hours apart, and at other times she was nearly starved to death before they brought it. She sorely wished they would do something about the chamber pot. They didn't bring her enough food either. Her dress was getting quite loose at the hips and bust. She had wished for the last several years that she could be a bit smaller, as she had been before she went on her journey 20 years before. She had been thought attractive in her youth. Her extra weight always seemed a reminder of that lost youth and beauty. She laughed maniacally. Maybe they thought so too, and decided to put the prelate on a fast. Her laughter died. She had wished Jedediah would see what was on the inside instead of just the outside, and here she was longing for the outside just as he did. A tear rolled down her cheek. Warren had never ignored what was inside. She was a fool. "I pray you are safe, Warren," she whispered to the walls. Verna slid the tray across the floor toward the candle. She flopped down and snatched up the tin cup of water. Before she gulped it down, she stopped, cautioning herself to make it last. They never brought her enough water. Too often she gulped it down and then spent the next day lying in her bed daydreaming about diving into a lake with her mouth open, guzzling down as much as she wanted. She put the cup to her lips and took a dainty sip. When she set it back on the tray, she saw something new, something other than the half loaf of bread. There sat a bowl of soup. Verna reverently lifted it, inhaling the aroma. It was a thin onion broth, but it seemed a queen's feast. Nearly in tears with joy, she took a swallow, savoring the rich flavor. She tore off a chunk of bread and dunked it in the soup. It tasted better than chocolate, better than anything she had ever eaten. She broke the rest of the bread into small pieces and dumped them all in the bowl. Swelling in the soup, it made the bread seem more than she could eat, but she did. As she ate, she worked the journey book from its pouch in her belt. Her hopes sagged again as there was no new message. She had told Anne what had happened, and she had received back a hastily scrawled message that said only, "You must escape and get the sisters away." She had received no message since. After she had tipped up the bowl and drained the last of the soup, she blew out the candle, saving it for later. She put the half cup of water behind the candle so as to help ensure she wouldn't spill it in the dark, and then lay back on the pallet, rubbing her full stomach. She woke from a dead sleep when she heard the door lever clang as it was lifted. Verna put the back of a hand to her eyes, protecting them from the dazzling illumination that stabbed into the room. She scooted back against the wall as the door closed. A woman stood holding a lamp. Verna squinted in its blinding brightness. The woman set the lamp on the floor and straightened to fold her hands at her waist. She stood watching, saying nothing. "Who is it? Who's there?"
"Sister Leoma Marsick," came the terse reply.
Verna blinked as her eyes finally acclimated to the lamplight. Yes, it was Leoma. Verna could make out her wrinkled face and long white hair hanging back over her shoulders. Leoma was the one in the prelate's office, the one who had put her in here. Verna sprang for the woman's throat. Confused for a moment, she realized she was sitting back on her pallet, and her behind smarted from the rough landing. She felt the disturbing sensation of the Radahan preventing her from rising. She tried to move her legs, but they wouldn't respond. It was a singularly terrifying sensation. She gasped for air, fighting back a cry of panic. She stopped trying to fight it, to stand,
and the alarm eased, but the disquieting, extrinsic feeling didn't.
That will be quite enough, Verna.
Verna made sure her voice was under control before she spoke. What am I doing in here?
You were being held until your trial had concluded.
Trial? What trial? No, she would not give Leoma the satisfaction.
That would seem appropriate.
Verna wished she could stand. It was shaming to have Leoma looking down upon her like this.
And has it then?
That is why I'm here. I've come to inform you of the decision of the tribunal. Verna bit off her caustic reply. Of course, these traitors found her guilty of some fraudulent charge.
And their decision, then? You have been found guilty of being a sister of the dark.
Verna was struck speechless. She stared up at Leoma, but couldn't bring forth a word at the pain of having sisters convict her of that. She had worked nearly her whole life to see the Creator honored in this world. Rage boiled up, but she held it in check, remembering Warren's admonition about her temper.
Sister of the dark. I see.
And how could I have been convicted of such an accusation without evidence? Leoma chuckled.
Come now, Verna. Surely you would not believe you could get away with such a high crime and leave no evidence.
No. I suppose you managed to find something. Do you intend to tell me, then, or did you simply come here to gloat over having at last managed to make yourself prelate? Leoma lifted an eyebrow.
Oh, I have not been named prelate. Sister Ulyssia was chosen.
Verna flinched.
Ulyssia?
Ulyssia is a sister of the dark. She fled with five of her collaborators.
Quite the contrary. Sisters Tovi, Cecilia, Armina, Nikki, and Marissa have all returned, and have been reinstated to their positions of authority as sisters of the light.
Verna struggled mightily, but unsuccessfully, to rise to her feet.
They were caught attacking Prelate Annalena. Ulyssia killed her. They all fled.
Leoma sighed, as if having to explain the most simple of things to an ignorant novice.
And who caught them attacking Prelate Annalena?
She paused.
You. You and Richard. The six sisters have testified how they were attacked by a sister of the dark, after Richard had killed Sister Liliana, and they fled for their lives until they could arrange their return, in order to save the palace from your grip. The misunderstanding has been set straight. It was you, a sister of the dark, who masterminded that accusation. You and Richard were the only witnesses. It was you who killed Prelate Annalena. You and Richard Rawl, whom you then aided in escaping. We heard testimony by sisters who overheard you telling one of the guards, Kevin Andelmere, that he must be loyal to Richard, your accomplice, instead of the Emperor.
Verna shook her head in disbelief.
So you took the word of six of the Keeper's minions, and on that basis, because there are more of them than one of me, convicted me? Hardly. There were days and days of testimony and evidence presented, so much, in fact, that your trial has taken nearly 2 weeks. We wanted to make sure, in the interest of justice, and considering the seriousness of the charges, that we were completely fair and thorough. A great number of witnesses came forth to reveal the extent of your nefarious work.
Verna threw her hands up.
What are you talking about? You have been methodically destroying the work of the palace. Thousands of years of tradition and effort have been overturned in your effort to bring the work of the Sisters of the Light to ruin. Problems you caused were extensive. The people in the city rioted, because you had ordered the palace to halt payments to women who had become pregnant by our young wizards. Those children are one of our main sources of boys with the gift. You wished to strangle that source. You stopped our young men from going to the city to see to their needs and produce those offspring with the gift. It came to a head last week, when we had a riot that had to be put down by the guards. The people were about to storm the palace because of our cruelty in letting those young women and their children starve. Many of our young men joined in the uprising because you cut off their right to palace gold.
Verna wondered just what the true nature of the uprising had been, considering that young wizards were involved, but she didn't think Leoma would be forthcoming with the truth of it. Verna knew that there were good men among those young wizards and feared their fate.
Our gold corrupts the morals of everyone it touches, Verna said.
She knew it was a waste to try to defend herself. This woman was not amenable to reason or the truth.
It has worked for thousands of years, but of course you would not want the benefits of this design to come to fruit in order to aid the Creator. These orders have been reversed, as have others of your ruinous directives. You would not want us to be able to determine if young men were prepared to face the world. You want them to fail, and so you disallow the test of pain. That order, too, has been reversed. You have been defiling palace doctrine since the day you became prelate. You yourself are the one responsible for the prelate's death. And then you use your underworld tricks to install yourself as prelate so you may destroy us. You never listen to the advice of your advisors. because you never had any intent of preserving the palace. You no longer even bother to look at reports, but instead burden inexperienced administrators with your work while you lock yourself in your sanctuary to confer with the keeper.
Verna sighed. That's it, then. My administrators don't like having to work.
Some avaricious people are unhappy because I refuse to hand out gold from the palace treasury, simply because they choose to get pregnant rather than establish their own families to bring children into the world. Some sisters are disgruntled because I won't allow our young men to indulge in unrestrained self-gratification. The words of six sisters who flee rather than stay to be questioned are suddenly taken seriously. And you even name one of them prelate, all without so much as a single piece of hard evidence.
A smile finally came to Leoma's lips.
Oh, we have hard evidence, Verna. We do indeed.
With a smug expression, she reached into a pocket and pulled out a piece of paper.
We had some very hard, very condemning evidence, Verna.
She solemnly unfurled the paper as her austere gaze again settled on Verna.
And one other witness. Warren.
Verna flinched as if she had been struck across the face. She recalled the messages she had received from the prelate and Nathan. Nathan had been in a panic that Warren must get away from the palace. Anne had been emphatic that Verna make sure Warren left at once.
Do you know what this is, Verna?
Verna dared not speak or even blink.
I think you do. It's a prophecy. Only a sister of the dark would be so arrogant as to leave such an incriminating document lying about. We found it down in the vaults, stuffed in a book. Perhaps you've forgotten all about it. Let me read it, then. When the prelate and the prophet are given to the light in a sacred rite, the flames will bring to boil a cauldron of guile and give ascension to a false prelate, who will reign over the death of the palace of the prophets.
Leoma folded the paper and slipped it back into her pocket.
You knew Warren was a prophet, and you took off his collar. You let a prophet roam free, a grievous offense in itself.
And what makes you think Warren gave this prophecy? Verna asked cautiously.
Warren testified that he did. It took a while for him to decide to speak his guilt in giving prophecy.
Verna's voice heated.
What did you do to him? We used his Radahan, as is our duty, to elicit the truth. In the end, he confessed that the prophecy was his. His Radahan. You put a collar back on him. Of course, a prophet must be collared. As prelate, it was your duty to see it done. Warren is back in a collar and under shields and guard at the prophet's quarters where he belongs. The palace of the prophets has once again been set back to the way it is meant to be. This prophecy was the final condemning piece of evidence. It proved the duplicity in your actions and revealed your true intent. Fortunately, we were able to act before you could bring the prophecy to fruition. You have failed.
You know none of that is true.
Warren's prophecy proves your guilt. It names you a false prelate and reveals your plans to destroy the palace of the prophets.
Her smile returned.
It created quite a stir when it was read before the tribunal. Quite a condemning piece of hard evidence, I would say.
You vile beast. I will see you dead.
I would expect no less from one such as you. Fortunately, you are in no position to make good on your threats.
Looking up into Leoma's eyes, Verna kissed her ring finger.
Why don't you kiss your finger, Sister Leoma, and beseech the Creator's help in this time of trouble for the Palace of the Prophets?
Wearing a mocking smile, Leoma spread her hands.
The palace has no trouble now, Verna.
Kiss your finger, Leoma, and show the beloved Creator your solicitude for the well-being of the Sisters of the Light. Leoma didn't bring her hand to her lips. She couldn't, and Verna knew it.
I have not come here to pray to the Creator.
Of course not, Leoma. You and I both know that you're a sister of the dark, as is the new prelate. Ulyssia is the false prelate in the prophecy. Leoma shrugged.
You, Verna, are the first sister ever to be convicted of such a high crime. There is no longer any doubt. Conviction cannot be overturned.
We're alone, Leoma. No one can hear us behind all those shields, except, of course, one with subtractive magic, and you've no need to fear those ears. None of the true sisters of the light can hear anything we say. If I tried to tell anyone anything you might have to say, no one would believe me. So let's drop the pretense, Leoma. We both know the truth.
A small smile spread onto Leoma's lips. Go on.
Verna took a calming breath and folded her hands in her lap.
You haven't killed me, as Ulyssia killed Prelate Annalena. You wouldn't have bothered to go through this whole sham if you intended to kill me. You could have killed me in my office. You obviously want something.
What is it?
Leoma chuckled. Ah, Verna, you always were one to cut right to the heart of the matter. You're not very old, but I must admit you are a smart one.
Yes, I'm just brilliant. That's why I'm sitting here. What is it your master, the Keeper, wants you to get from me?
Leoma pursed her lips.
At the moment, we serve another master. It is what he wants that is important.
Verna frowned. Jagang? You've given an oath to him, too?
Leoma's gaze darted away for an instant.
Not exactly. But that's beside the point.
Jagang wants things, and he shall have them. It is my duty to see to it that he gets what he wants.
And what is it you want from me?
You must forsake your loyalty to Richard Rawl.
You're dreaming if you think I'll do that.
An ironic smile came to Leoma's face.
Yes, I have been dreaming, but that too is beside the point. You must give up your bond to Richard.
Why?
Richard has a way of interfering with the Emperor's control of events.
You see, loyalty to Richard blocks Jagang's power.
He wishes to see if this loyalty can be broken, so that he can enter your mind. It's an experiment of sorts. It's my task to convince you to forsake that loyalty.
I'll do no such thing. You can't make me abandon my fidelity to Richard.
Leoma's smile turned grim as she nodded.
Oh, yes, I can. And I will. I have a great deal of motivation. Before Jagang finally arrives to establish his headquarters here, I will break the bond to his enemy.
How? By cutting off my Han? You think that will break my will?
You forget so easily, Verna. You forget the other uses the Radahan has. You forget the test of pain. Sooner or later, you will be on your knees begging to swear fidelity to the Emperor. You make a grave mistake if you think I will balk at such a gruesome task. You make a grave mistake if you forget what I am, or think I have an ounce of sympathy. We have weeks yet before Jagang arrives. We have all the time we need. Those weeks under the test will seem like years to you until you submit, but submit you will.
Verna stiffened. She had forgotten the test of pain. She felt the constriction of terror rising in her throat again. She had seen it done to young men in a Radahan, of course, but it was never done for more than an hour, with years between tests.
Leoma stepped closer and kicked the cup of water aside.
Shall we begin, Sister Verna?
Chapter 43. Richard winced when he saw the boy knocked senseless. Some of the bystanders pulled him aside, and another boy took his place. Even from behind the high window in the confessor's palace, he could hear the cheers from the crowd of children watching the boys play the game he had seen children in Tanamura playing, Jala. In his homeland of Westland, he had never heard of Jala, but children in the Midlands played it just as did those in the Old World. The spirited game was fast-paced and looked exciting, but he didn't think children should have to pay the price of having their teeth knocked out for the fun of a game.
"Lord Rawl," Ulick called. "Lord Rawl, are you here?"
Richard turned from the window and let the comforting shroud go as he flung the black Mriswith cape back over his shoulders.
"Yes, Ulick, what is it?"
The big guard strode into the room when he saw Richard seem to appear out of the air. He was used to the sight.
"There is a Keltish general here asking to see you, General Baldwin."
Richard touched his fingertips to his forehead as his mind searched.
"Baldwin, Baldwin," he looked up.
"General Baldwin, yes, I remember. He's the commander of all Keltish forces. We sent him a letter about Kelton's surrender."
"What does he want?"
Ulick shrugged.
"He would only say that he wants to speak with Lord Rawl."
Richard turned to the window, pushing the heavy gold drape back with a hand as he idly leaned against the painted window casing. He watched a boy doubled over, recovering from a hit with the brock. The boy straightened and went back to the play.
"How many men accompanied the general to Adendrill?"
"A small guard of 5, maybe 600.
"He was told that Kelton had surrendered. If he meant trouble, he wouldn't march into Adendrill with so few men. I guess I had better see him."
He turned back to the attentive Ulick.
"Berdeen is busy. Have Kara and Reyna escort the general in."
Ulick clapped a fist to his heart and started to turn away, but turned back when Richard called his name.
"Have the men found anything more at the bottom of the mountain below the keep?"
"No, Lord Rawl. Nothing more than all those parts of Mriswith. The snow at the base of that cliff has drifted so deep that it will be spring when it melts before we can discover what else fell from the keep. The wind could have carried whatever fell anywhere, and the soldiers have no idea where in that vast tract to dig. The Mriswith arms and claws they found were light enough so that they didn't drive under the snow. Anything heavier could have gone down 10, maybe 20 feet in that light wind-blown fluff."
Richard nodded in disappointment.
"One other thing. The palace must have seamstresses. Find the head seamstress and ask her to please come see me. Richard pulled his black Mriswith cape around himself without really thinking about what he was doing and went back to watching the Jala game. He was impatient for Kalin and Zed to arrive. It shouldn't be long now. They must be close. Surely Gratch had found them, and they would all be together soon. He heard Kara's voice behind him at the door.
Lord Rahl?
Richard turned, letting the cape fall open as he relaxed. Standing tall between the two Mordsith was a sturdily built older man with a white-flecked dark mustache, the ends of which grew down to the bottom of his jaw, and graying black hair growing down over his ears. His pate shone through where his hair was thinning. He wore a heavy, semicircular serge cape, richly lined with green silk and fastened on one shoulder with two buttons. A tall, embroidered collar was turned down over a tan surcoat, decorated with a heraldic emblem, slashed through with a diagonal black line, dividing a yellow and blue shield. The man's high boots covered his knees. Long black gauntlets, their flared cuffs lying over the front, were tucked through a wide belt set with an ornate buckle. As Richard became visible before his eyes, the general's face paled and he lurched to a halt. Richard bowed. "General Baldwin, I'm pleased to meet you. I am Richard Rahl." The general at last regained his composure and returned the bow.
"Lord Rahl, I am honored that you will see me on such short notice."
Richard gestured. "Kara, please bring a chair for the general. He must be weary from his travel." After Kara had placed a simple tufted leather chair before the table and the general had seated himself, Richard sat in his own chair behind the table.
"What can I do for you, General Baldwin?"
The general glanced up at Reyna standing behind his left shoulder and Kara behind his right. Both women stood relaxed and silent with their hands clasped behind their backs, sending the unequivocal message that they had no intention of going anywhere.
"You may speak freely, General. I trust these two to watch over me when I sleep."
He took a breath and seemed to relax a bit, accepting the assurance.
"Lord Rahl, I've come about the Queen."
Richard had thought that might be it. He folded his hands on the table.
"I'm very sorry about what happened, General."
The general rested an arm on the table as he leaned in.
"Yes, I've heard about the Mriswith. I saw some of the loathsome beasts on the pikes outside."
Richard had to stop himself when he almost said that they might be beasts, but they weren't loathsome. A Mriswith, after all, had killed Catherine Lumholtz as she was trying to murder him. But the general wasn't likely to understand, so Richard kept it to himself and said instead,
"I deeply regret that your queen was killed while under my roof."
The general flipped his hand dismissively.
"I meant no imputation, Lord Rahl. What I mean is that I've come about Kelton being without a king or queen now that Catherine Lumholtz is dead. She was the last successor to the throne, and with her sudden death it presents a problem."
Richard kept his voice friendly but official.
"What sort of problem? You are part of us now."
The man distorted his features in an offhanded expression.
"Yes, we received the surrender documents. But the queen who led us is now dead. While she was in power, she acted within her authority. But we find ourselves at a loss as to how to proceed."
Richard frowned. "You mean you need a new queen or king?" He shrugged apologetically.
"It is our way to have a monarch lead our people. Even if it's only symbolic, now that we've surrendered to the union with Dahara, it gives the Keltish people esteem to have a king or queen. Without one, the people feel that they are no more than nomads, without roots, without anything in common to tie them together. Since there is no Lumholtz in line of succession, one of the other houses could come to the fore. None has the right to claim the throne, but one could eventually win the right. A contested throne could cause a civil war, though."
"I see," Richard said.
"You realize, of course, that whoever you choose for your king or queen doesn't make any difference as far as your surrender is concerned.
The surrender is irrevocable."
"It's not so simple. That's why I've come to seek your help."
"How can I help?" The general kneaded his chin.
"You see, Lord Rahl, Queen Catherine surrendered Kelton to you, but now she's dead. Until we have a new monarch, we are your subjects. You are the equivalent of our king until a true monarch is named. However, if one of these houses ascends to the throne, it could be that they see it differently."
Richard kept his tone from sounding as threatening as he felt.
"I don't care how they see it. That river has been crossed."
The general waggled his hand as if to implore patience.
"I think the future lies with you, Lord Rahl. The problem is that if the wrong house finally comes to the throne, they might have different ideas. Quite frankly, I would never have thought that the House of Lumholtz would have chosen to go with you and Dahara. You must have been very persuasive to make the queen see reason. Some of these dukes and duchesses are talented at playing games of power, but not at what is in the best interest of all. These duchies are almost sovereign, and their subjects bow only to a monarch. There are those who would speak persuasively for Kelton to heed the word of the crown, and not Dahara, should one of the wrong houses come to the throne and declare the surrender invalid. Civil war would be the result. I'm a soldier, and view events with a soldier's eye. A soldier likes least of all fighting a civil war. I have men from every duchy. Civil war would tear the unity of the army apart, destroy us, and leave us vulnerable to true enemies. Richard filled the silence. I'm listening. Go on. As I said, as a man who understands the value of unity, of unified authority, I think the future lies with you. Right now, until there is a new ruler on the throne, you are the law.
General Baldwin leaned sideways against the table and lowered his voice meaningfully.
Since you are the law at the moment, if you were to name a king or queen, then that would settle the matter. See what I mean? The houses would be obligated to honor the new ruler and go with you if the new ruler says it is to be as has already been done. Richard squinted.
You make it sound like a game, General. Moving this piece on the board to block an opposing piece before the opponent has his turn to take your marker. He smoothed down his mustache.
It's your move, Lord Rawl.
Richard leaned back in his chair.
I see.
He thought a moment, not knowing how he was going to get out of this. Maybe he could ask the general's advice as to which house would be loyal. He didn't think that would be wise, though, trusting a man who just walked in and announced his intent to help. It could be a ruse. He glanced at Kara, who stood to the side behind the general. Her shoulders were hunched and her face wore a silent, confounded expression. When he moved his gaze to Reyna, she signaled that she too didn't have any suggestions. Richard rose and went to the window, staring out at the people in the city. He wished Kaelin were here. She knew all about this kind of thing, the ways of royalty and rulers. This taking over the Midlands business was constantly proving more complicated than he had expected. He could simply order this nonsense stopped and send in Dahiran troops to enforce his orders, but that would waste valuable men taking care of what should already be settled. He could leave the matter until later, but he needed Kelton to remain loyal. Other lands' surrender hinged on Kelton. He already had Kelton, but if he made a mistake, all his plans could end in ashes. Richard wished Kaelin would hurry up and get to Adendrill. She could tell him what he needed to do. Perhaps he could stall until she and Zed arrived, and with her advice, do the right thing. She should be here soon, but would it be soon enough?
Kaelin, what should I do?
Kaelin. Richard turned back to the waiting general.
Since Kelton needs a monarch to stand as a symbol of hope and leadership for all Keltish people, I shall name one for you.
The general waited expectantly.
By my authority as Master of Dahara, to whom Kelton owes its allegiance, I name your queen. From this day forward, Kaelin Amnell is the Queen of Kelton.
General Baldwin's eyes widened as he came out of his chair.
You name Kaelin Amnell as our queen?
Richard hardened his gaze as his hand settled on the hilt of his sword.
I do. All Kelton will bow to her. Like your surrender, this order is irrevocable.
General Baldwin dropped to his knees, his head hanging low.
Lord Rawl, I can hardly believe you would do this for my people. We are grateful.
Richard, his hand on the verge of drawing his sword, paused at the general's words. He hadn't expected such a reaction. The general finally came to his feet before the table.
Lord Rawl, I must leave at once to bring this glorious news to our troops. They will be as honored as I to be the subjects of Kaelin Amnell.
Richard, unsure how to react, remained noncommittal.
I'm pleased that you would accept my choice, General Baldwin.
The general spread his arms.
Accept? This is beyond my hopes, Lord Rawl. Kaelin Amnell is the Queen of Galia. It has been a cause of strife in our land that the Mother Confessor herself would serve as queen to our rival Galia, but to now have her as our queen too, well, it will prove that the Lord Rawl holds us in the same high esteem as Galia. When you are wedded to her, you will be wedded to our people too, the same as the Galeans.
Richard was stiff and speechless. How did the man know that Kaelin was the Mother Confessor? Dear spirits, what had happened? General Baldwin reached out and pulled Richard's hand from his sword, clasping it in a warm embrace.
Lord Rawl, this is the greatest honor our people have ever received. To have the Mother Confessor herself as our queen. Thank you, Lord Rawl, thank you.
General Baldwin was grinning joyously, but Richard was on the verge of panic.
It is my hope, General, that this will seal our unity.
Waving a hand, the general laughed with glee.
For all time, Lord Rawl.
Now, if you will excuse me, I must return at once to let our people know of this great day.
Of course, Richard managed to get out.
General Baldwin clasped hands with Kara and Raina before rushing from the room. Richard stood stunned.
Kara frowned.
Lord Rahl, is something wrong? Your face is as pale as ashes.
Richard finally took his gaze from the door the general had gone through and looked to her.
He knew that Kaelin is the Mother Confessor.
Kara's brow twitched as if she were mystified.
Everyone knows that your bride-to-be, Kaelin Amnell, is the Mother Confessor.
What? He whispered.
You know, too.
She and Raina nodded, Raina speaking.
Naturally. Lord Rahl, you do not look well. Are you ill? Perhaps you should sit down.
Richard looked from Raina's questioning face back to Kara.
She had a spell on her to protect her.
No one knew she was the Mother Confessor, no one.
A great wizard used magic to hide her identity. You never knew before.
Kara frowned, truly puzzled now.
We didn't? That's most odd, Lord Rahl. It seems to me that I've always known she was the Mother Confessor.
Raina nodded her agreement.
Impossible, Richard said.
He turned to the door.
Ulic, Egan!
They burst through the door almost instantly, poised and ready for combat.
What is it, Lord Rahl?
Who am I to marry?
Both men straightened in surprise.
The Queen of Galia, Lord Rahl, Ulic said.
Who is she?
The two men shared a confused glimpse at one another.
Well, Egan said, she is the Queen of Galia. Kaelin Amnell, the Mother Confessor.
The Mother Confessor is supposed to be dead. Don't any of you remember the speech I gave to all the representatives down in the council chambers? Don't you remember how I talked about how they should honor the memory of the dead Mother Confessor by joining with Dahara?
Ulic scratched his head. Egan stared at the floor while he sucked the tip of a finger in concentration. Raina looked to the others, hoping they would have an answer. Kara's face finally brightened.
I think I remember, Lord Rahl, she said. But I think you were speaking of past Mother Confessors in general, not your bride-to-be.
Richard looked from one face to another as each nodded.
Look, I know you don't understand, but this involves magic.
You're right then, Lord Rahl,
Raina said, turning more serious.
If there's a magic spell involved, then the spell would deceive us. You have magic, so you would be able to discern the difficulty. We must trust in what you tell us about magic.
Richard rubbed his hands together as he looked off, his eyes unable to find a place to settle. Something was wrong. Something was terribly wrong, but what?
Maybe Zed lifted the spell. Maybe he had a reason. It could be that there was nothing wrong. Zed was with her. Zed would protect her.
Richard spun around.
The letter. I sent them a letter.
Maybe Zed removed the spell because he knows that I've taken Adendrill from the Imperial Order, so he didn't think there was any need to keep her spelled.
That sounds reasonable, Kara offered.
Richard felt a wave of worry rise into his throat. What if Kaelin was furious that he had ended the alliance of the Midlands, and had demanded the surrender of the lands to Dahara, and so she had insisted that Zed take off the spell to let people know the Midlands still had a Mother Confessor? If so, that would mean she wasn't in trouble, but that she was angry with him. Anger, he could accept. Trouble, he could not. If she was in trouble, he had to help her.
Ulic, please go find General Rybish and bring him to me at once.
Ulic tapped a fist to his chest and rushed from the room.
Egan, you go visit some of the officers and men. Don't act as if it's anything out of the ordinary. Just engage them in conversation about me. Maybe my marriage or something like that. See if others also know that Kaelin is the Mother Confessor.
Richard paced and thought as he waited for General Rybish to arrive.
What should he do?
Kaelin and Zed should be here at any time. But what if something was wrong? Even if Kaelin was angry about what he had done, that wouldn't stop her from coming to Adendrill. It would only make her want to talk him out of it, or lecture him on the history of the Midlands and what he was destroying. Maybe she would want to tell him that their marriage was off and she never wanted to see him again. No, he could not believe that. Kaelin loved him, and even if she was angry, he refused to believe that she would willingly put anything before her love for him. He had to believe in her love, just as she had to believe in his. The door opened, and Berdine struggled into the room with her arms full of books and papers. She had a pen between her teeth. She smiled as best she could with a pen in her mouth and dumped the things on the table.
We need to talk, she whispered, if you're not busy.
Ulic went out to look for General Rybish. It's urgent that I talk to him.
Berdine glanced to Kara, Raina, and the door.
Do you want me to leave, Lord Rahl? Is something wrong?
Already Richard had learned enough to know he was right about the journal they had found being important. He could do nothing until Rybish returned.
Who am I to marry?
Verdine opened a book on the table as she sat in his chair and shuffled through the papers she had brought.
Queen Caelan Amnell, the Mother Confessor.
She looked up hopefully.
Do you have a bit of time? I could use your help.
Richard sighed and went around the desk to stand beside her.
Until General Rybish gets here, I've got time. What do you need?
With the back end of her pen, she tapped the open journal.
I've almost got this bit here translated, and it seems he was emphatic about it when he wrote it, but I'm missing two words that I think are important.
She pulled the high Dharan version of the adventures of Bonnie Day around before them.
I found a place with the same two words in this. If you can remember what it says, I'll have it.
Richard had read The Adventures of Bonnie Day countless times. It was his favorite book, and he thought he could recite it by heart. He had discovered that he could not. He knew the book well, but remembering the exact words proved harder than he had thought it would be. He could remember the story, but not the exact story, word for word. Unless he could tell her the exact words of a sentence, the gist of the story wasn't often of much help. He had gone to the keep several times and searched for a version of the book he could read so they could cross-reference the Dharan version, but he hadn't been able to find one. It was frustrating that he couldn't be of more help. Verdine pointed to a place in The Adventures of Bonnie Day.
I need these two words. Can you tell me what this sentence says?
Richard's hopes rose. It was the beginning of a chapter. He had had the most success with the beginnings of chapters because the starting places were memorable.
Yes, this is the chapter where they leave.
I remember. It starts,
For the third time that week, Bonnie violated her father's rule about not going into the woods alone. Verdine leaned over, looking at the line.
Yes, this is violated. I've already got that one. This word here is rule, and this one third?
Richard nodded when she glanced up. Grinning with the thrill of discovery, she dipped her pen in the bottle of ink and started writing on one of the sheets of paper she had brought, filling in a few of the blank places. When she finished, she proudly slid the paper over in front of him.
This is what it says in this bit of the journal.
Richard picked up the paper and held it up in the light coming over his shoulder from the window.
The arguments rage on among us. Wizard's third rule. Passion rules reason. I fear this most insidious of rules may be our ruin. Though we know better, I fear some of us are violating it anyway. Each faction presses that their course of action is reason, but in the desperation I fear all are passion. Even Alric Rall sends frantic word of a solution. Meanwhile the dreamwalkers scythe through our men. I pray the towers can be completed, or we are all lost. Today I said goodbye to friends leaving for the towers. I wept to know I will never see those good men again in this world. How many will die in the towers for the cause of reason? But alas, I know the worst cost should we violate the third rule.
When Richard finished the translation, he turned away toward the window. He had been in those towers. He knew that wizards had given their life force into them to ignite the tower's spells, but they had never seemed real people to him before. It was chilling to read the anguish in the words of the man whose bones had lain in that room in the keep for thousands of years. Through the words in the journal, his bones seemed to be coming to life. Richard thought about the third rule, trying to reason it out for himself. Before, for the first and second, he had had Zed and then Nathan to explain it for him, to help him see how the rules worked in life. He would have to work this one out himself. He recalled going down to the roads leading out of Adendril to talk to some of the people fleeing the city. He had wanted to know why they would leave, and had been told by fearful people that they knew the truth, that he was a monster who would slaughter them for his twisted pleasure. When pressed, they quoted rumor as if it were fact seen with their own eyes, rumor of how the Lord Rall had children as slaves in the palace, how he took countless young women to his bed, leaving them senseless from the experience to wander the streets naked. They claimed to know young women and girls whom he had gotten pregnant, and furthermore knew people who had actually seen the miscarriages of some of these poor victims of his rape, and they had been hideous, misshapen freaks, the spawn of his evil seed. They spat at him for the crimes he committed against helpless people. He asked them how they could be so frank with him if he were such a monster. They said that they knew he wouldn't do them harm in the open, that they had heard how he pretended to be compassionate in public so as to fool people, so they knew he would do nothing to them in front of the crowds, and they would soon have their womenfolk away from his evil clutches. The more Richard tried to put to rest baffling beliefs, the more tenaciously the people clung to them. They said they had heard these things from too many others for it to be anything but true. Such common knowledge could not be false, they said, as it would be impossible to fool so many people. They were passionate in their belief and their fear, and would hear no arguments of logic.
They simply wanted to be left alone to run to the protection they had heard was offered by the Imperial Order. Their passion was going to bring them to true ruin. He wondered if this could be how violation of the Third Rule hurt people. He didn't know if it was a solid enough example. It seemed tangled with the First Rule. People would believe any lie, either because they wanted it to be true or because they feared it was. It seemed it could be several rules mixed together, violated in tandem, and he couldn't tell where one ended and the other began. And then Richard recalled the day back home in Westland, when Mrs. Rencliffe, who could not swim, had wrenched her arms from the men trying to hold her back, refusing to wait for the rowboat, and had leapt into a flood-swollen river after her boy who had fallen in. The men rushed up a few minutes later with the rowboat and saved the boy's life. Chad Rencliffe grew up without a mother. They never found her body. Richard's skin prickled as if ice had touched it. He understood. Wizard's Third Rule. Passion rules reason. It was a distressing hour of detailing the way people's passion instead of reason brought them to harm, and worse, wondering how magic could add ruin to the equation, as he knew it would, before Ulic finally returned with the general. General Rybish clapped a fist to his heart as he entered the room.
Lord Rawl, Ulic said you were in a hurry to see me.
Richard gripped the bearded man's dark uniform. How long will it take you to get men ready to leave on a search?
Lord Rawl, they're Dharans. Dharan soldiers are always ready to leave on a moment's notice.
Good. You know my bride-to-be, Queen Kaelin Amnell? General Rybish nodded.
Yes, the Mother Confessor.
Richard winced. Yes, the Mother Confessor. She's on her way here from the southwest. She's past due, and there may be trouble. She had a spell over her to protect her identity as the Mother Confessor, so that her enemies couldn't hunt her. Somehow the spell has been removed. It might be nothing, but it could be that it means trouble. For sure, her enemies will now know of her. The man scratched his rust-colored beard. His grayish-green eyes came up at last.
I see. What would you like me to do?
We have close to 200,000 men in Adendrill, with another 100,000 scattered all around the perimeter of the city. I don't know exactly where she is, except that she's supposed to be to the southwest and on her way here. We have to protect her. I want you to get a force together, half the troops in the city, 100,000 at least, to go out after her. The general stroked his scar as he heaved a sigh.
That's a lot of men, Lord Rawl. Do you think we need to take that many from the city?
Richard paced between the desk and the general. I don't know exactly where she is. If we take too few, we could miss her by 50 miles and wander off without ever making contact. With that many men, we can fan out as we go, cast a wide net, covering all the roads and trails so we don't miss her.
You will be going with us, then?
Richard desperately wanted to go find Kaelin and Zed. He glanced to Berdine sitting behind the desk as she worked, and thought about the words of warning from a 3,000-year-old wizard. Wizard's Third Rule. Passion rules reason. Berdine needed his help to translate the journal. He was already learning important things about the last war, and the towers, and the dreamwalkers. A dreamwalker again walked the world. If he did go, and Kaelin slipped past him where he searched, it might take longer for him to join with her than if he simply waited in Adendrill. And then there was the keep. Something had happened at the keep, and it was his duty to guard the magic there. Richard's passion told him to go. He desperately wanted to search for Kaelin. But in his mind's eye he saw Mrs. Rencliffe diving into the dark rushing water, refusing to wait for the boat. These men were his boat. The troops could find Kaelin and protect her. He could do nothing to add to that protection. Reason told him to wait here, as much anxiety as that would cause him. Like it or not, he was a leader now. A leader had to act with reason, or everyone would pay the price of his passion. No, General, I'll remain in Adendrill. Get the troops together, take the best trackers. He looked to the man's eyes. I know I don't have to tell you how important this is to me.
No, Lord Rawl, the general said in a compassionate tone. Don't worry, we'll find her. I'll go with the men to make certain that everything is done with the same care as you would do it if you were there.
He put his fist to his heart.
Every one of our lives before harm touches your queen.
Richard laid a hand to the man's shoulder.
Thank you, General Rybish.
I know I could do no more than you will. May the good spirits be with you.
Chapter 44
Please, Wizard Zorander.
The skinny wizard didn't glance up from spooning beans and bacon into his mouth. She didn't know how the man could eat as much as he did.
Are you listening?
It wasn't like her to yell, but she was near the end of her patience. This was proving to be even more trouble than she had envisioned. She knew she had to do this to cultivate his hostility, but this was too much.
With a pleased sigh, Wizard Zorander tossed his tin bowl down with their packs.
"Good night, Nathan."
Nathan lifted an eyebrow as Wizard Zorander crawled into his bedroll.
"Good night, Zed."
Nathan, too, was becoming dangerously difficult to deal with since she had captured the old wizard. He had never had such a talented cohort before. Anne sprang to her feet and stood with her fists on her hips as she glared down at the white hair sticking from the blanket.
"Wizard Zorander, I'm begging you."
It infuriated her to implore his aid in such a humble fashion, but she had learned the hard way what the results could be when she used the power of his collar to bring him to task through unpleasant means. How the man could manage to get those tricks through the blocks she had locked on his collar mystified her, but get them through he did, to the great amusement of Nathan. She was not amused. Anne was near tears.
"Please, Wizard Zorander."
His head turned up, the firelight casting the lines of his bony face in harsh shadows, his hazel eyes fixed on her.
"If you open that book again, you will die."
With ghost-like stealth, he slipped spells around her shields when she least expected it. She was at a loss to understand how he had put a light spell on the journey book. She had opened it that night and had seen the message from Verna that she had been captured and put in a collar, and then everything had gone terribly wrong. Opening the book had triggered the light spell. She had seen it swell and flare. Bright, burning cinder had shot up into the air, and the old wizard had calmly told her that if she didn't close the book by the time the glowing spark of light hit the ground, she would be incinerated. With one eye on the hissing spark as it descended, she had managed only to scrawl a hurried message to Verna that she must escape and get the sisters away. She had closed the book just in time. She knew he was not jesting about the deadly nature of the spell around the book. She could see the softly glowing spell around it now. She had never seen one quite like it, and how he had managed to set it when she thought she had his power blocked, she couldn't fathom. Nathan didn't understand it either, but he seemed quite interested. She knew of no way to open the book without being killed. Anne squatted down beside the bedroll.
"Wizard Zorander, I know you have a good reason to rail against me, but this is a matter of life and death. I must get a message through. The lives of sisters are at stake. Wizard Zorander, please. Sisters could die. I know you are a good man and wouldn't want that."
He brought a finger out from under the blanket and pointed it at her.
"You bonded me into slavery. You have brought this upon yourself and your sisters. I told you, you broke the truce, and have sentenced your sisters to death. You are endangering the lives of ones I love. They could die because you wouldn't let me help them. You took me from protecting the things of magic in the keep. You are endangering the lives of my people in the Midlands. They could all die because of what you have done to me. Can't you understand that all our lives are tied together? This is a war against the Imperial Order, not between us. I have no wish to harm you, only to have you help me." He grunted. "Don't forget what I told you. Either you or Nathan had better remain awake at all times. If I catch you asleep and Nathan isn't awake to protect you, you will never wake again. Fair warning, though you don't deserve it."
He rolled over and pulled the blanket up. Dear Creator, was this happening the way the prophecy intended, or had everything gone terribly wrong? Anne moved around the fire to Nathan.
"Nathan, do you think you could talk some sense into him?"
Nathan glanced down at her.
"I told you that this part of the plan is the true madness. Collaring a young man is one thing. Collaring a wizard of the First Order is quite another. This is your plan, not mine."
She clenched her teeth as she snatched his shirt.
"Verna could be killed in that collar. If she is killed, our sisters could die too."
He took a spoonful of beans.
"I've been warning you against this plan from the beginning. You were nearly killed at the keep, but this part of the prophecy is even more dangerous. I've talked to him. He's telling you the truth. As far as he is concerned, you are placing his friends in mortal danger. If he can, he will kill you in order to escape and go help them. No doubt in my mind."
"Nathan, after all the years we've been together, how could you be so callous about this?"
"You mean, after all these years of captivity, how can I still rebel against it?"
Anne turned her face away as a tear ran down her cheek. She swallowed back the lump in her throat.
"Nathan," she whispered, "in all the time you've known me, have you ever once seen me do anything cruel to someone other than because I had to protect lives? Have you ever once known me to struggle other than to preserve life and freedom?"
"I presume you mean other than my freedom."
She cleared her throat.
"And I know I will have to answer to the Creator for that, but I do it because I must and because I care for you, Nathan. I know what would happen to you out in the world. You would be hunted down and killed by people who don't understand you."
Nathan tossed his bowl atop the others.
You want first watch or second?
She turned back to him.
If you want your freedom so badly, what's keeping you from falling asleep on your watch so I will be killed?
His piercing blue eyes took on an acrimonious set.
I want this collar off. The one thing I will not do is kill you to accomplish the task. If I were willing to pay that price, you would be dead 1,000 times over and you know it.
I'm sorry, Nathan. I know you're a good man and I'm fully aware of the vital part you played in helping me preserve life. Forcing you to help me makes my heart ache.
Force me? He laughed. Anne, you're more fun than any woman I've ever met. Most of it I wouldn't have missed for anything. What other woman would buy me a sword or give me need to use it? That foolhardy prophecy says you have to bring him angry, and you're doing a splendid job of it. I fear it might even work. I'll take first watch. Don't forget to check your bedroll. No telling what he might have enticed in there this time. I still haven't figured out the snow fleas.
Me neither. I'm still itching. She absently scratched her neck. We're almost home. At the rate we're running, it won't be long.
Home, he mocked. And then you kill us.
Dear Creator, she whispered to herself. What choice have I? Richard leaned back in his chair and yawned. He was so tired he could hardly keep his eyes open. When he stretched and yawned, it caused Berdine, sitting next to him, to do the same. Across the room at the door, Raina was infected by their yawns. A knock came and Richard shot to his feet.
Come! Egan stuck his head in. A messenger is here.
Richard motioned and Egan's head disappeared. A Dharan soldier in a heavy cape and smelling of a horse hurried in and saluted with a fist to his heart.
Sit down. Look like you've had a hard ride, Richard said.
The soldier straightened his battle axe at his hip as he glanced to the chair.
I'm fine, Lord Rawl, but I'm afraid I've nothing to report.
Richard sank down in his chair.
I see. No sign, nothing?
No, Lord Rawl. General Rybish said to tell you they're making good time and are scouring every inch, and wanted me to assure you that our men have missed nothing, but so far they've found no sign.
Richard sighed in disappointment.
All right, thank you. You'd best go get something to eat. The man saluted and took his leave. Every day for 2 weeks, starting a week after the force had departed in search of Kalin, messengers had been returning to give Richard a report. Since the force had started splitting up to cover different routes, each group was sending its own messenger. This was the fifth of the day. Hearing the reports of what had happened weeks ago, when the messengers had left their troops, was like watching history happen. Everything he heard unfolding had happened in the past. For all Richard knew, they could have found Kalin a week ago, and were on their way back while he was still hearing reports of failure. He kept that constant hope foremost in his mind. He had filled the time and kept his mind from wandering into worried thoughts by working on translating the journal. It gave him much the same feeling as getting the reports every day, like watching history happen. Richard was rapidly coming to understand more of the Argo form of High Dharan than Berdine. Because he knew the story of the adventures of Bani Day, they had been working on that the most, making long lists of words as they discovered their meanings, giving them something to refer to when they worked on the journal. As he learned words, Richard was able to read more of the book, piecing together the exact wording, enabling him to fill in more of the blanks in his memory, and thus learn yet more words. It was often easier for him now to simply use what he had learned to translate from the journal than to show Berdine and have her do it. He was beginning to see High Dharan in his sleep and speak it when awake. The wizard who wrote the journal never named himself. It was not an official record but a private journal, so he had no need to call himself by name. Berdine and Richard had taken to calling him Kolo, short for Kolobleken, a High Dharan word meaning strong advisor. As Richard was able to understand more and more of the journal, a frightening picture was beginning to emerge. Kolo had written his journal during the ancient war that had spawned the creation of the Towers of Perdition in the Valley of the Lost. Sister Verna had once told him that the towers had stood guard over that valley for 3,000 years and had been placed to halt a great war. After learning how desperate these wizards had been to activate the towers, Richard was beginning to feel more and more troubled about having destroyed them. Kolo had mentioned in one place that his journals had been with him since he was a boy, and he filled about one a year, so this one, number 47, must have been written when he was somewhere in his early to mid-50s. Richard intended to go to the keep and search for Kolo's other journals, but this one still had many secrets to reveal. Apparently, Kolo was a trusted advisor to the others in the keep. Most of the other wizards had both sides of the gift, additive and subtractive, but a few had only additive.
Kolo felt great sorrow for, and was protective of, those born with only that one side of the gift. These unfortunate wizards were said to be viewed by many as next to helpless, but Kolo thought that they could contribute in their own unique way, and petitioned on their behalf for full status in the keep. In Kolo's time, hundreds of wizards lived at the keep, and it was alive with families, friends, and children. The now empty halls had at one time rung with laughter, conversation, and light-hearted rapport. Several times Kolo mentioned Frida, probably his wife, and his son and younger daughter. Children were restricted to certain levels in the keep, and went to lessons where they studied typical subjects like reading, writing, and mathematics, but also prophecy and the use of the gift. But over this great keep, teeming with life, work, and the joy of families, hung a pall of dread. The world was at war. Among Kolo's other duties was his turn at standing guard over the Slif. Richard remembered the Mriswith in the keep asking him if he had come to wake the Slif. It had pointed down at the room where they had found Kolo's journal and said she was accessible at last. Kolo, too, referred to the Slif as she, sometimes mentioning that she was watching him as he wrote in the journal. Because it was such a struggle to decipher the journal from Hyde to Harren, they had abandoned skipping around since it only tended to confuse them. It was easier to start at the beginning and translate every word as they went, thus learning Kolo's idiosyncrasies in the way he used language, making it easier to recognize patterns in his expressions. They were only about a fourth of the way into the journal, but the process was speeding up considerably as Richard was learning Hyde to Harren. While Richard leaned back and yawned again, Verdine bent toward him.
"What is this word?"
"Sword," he responded without hesitation. He remembered the word from the adventures of Bonnie Day.
"Huh. Look here, I think Kolo is speaking about your sword."
The front legs of Richard's chair thumped down as he came forward. He took the book and the piece of paper she had been using to write out the translation. Richard scanned the translation and then went back to the journal, forcing himself to read it in Kolo's words. The third attempt at forging a sword of truth failed today. The wives and children of the five men who died roam the halls, wailing in inconsolable anguish. How many men will die before we succeed, or until we abandon the attempt is impossible. The goal may be worthy, but the price is becoming terrible to bear.
You're right. It seems he's talking about when they were trying to make the sword of truth.
Richard felt a chill at learning that men had died in the making of his sword. In fact, it made him feel a little sick. He had always thought of the sword as an object of magic, thinking that maybe it had simply been a plain sword at one time that some powerful wizard had cast a spell over. Learning that people died in the effort to make it made him feel ashamed that he took it for granted most of the time. Richard went on to the next part of the journal. After an hour of consulting the lists and Verdine, he had it translated. "Last night, our enemies sent assassins through the Slif. Had the man on duty not been so alert, they would have succeeded. When the towers are ignited, the old world will truly be sealed away and the Slif will sleep. Then we can all rest easier, except the unlucky man on guard. We have concluded that we will have no way of knowing when the spells will be ignited, if they ever are, or if anyone is in the Slif, so the guard cannot be called away in time. When the towers are brought to life, the man on guard will be sealed in with her."
"The towers," Richard said. "When they completed the towers, sealing the old world from the new world, that room was also sealed. That's why Kolo was down there, he couldn't get out."
"Then why is the room open now?" Verdine asked.
"Because I destroyed the towers. Remember I told you that it looked like Kolo's room had been blasted open within the last few months? How the mold on the walls had been burned away and hadn't had time to regrow? It must have happened because I destroyed the towers. It also unsealed Kolo's room for the first time in 3,000 years.
"Why would they seal the room with the well?"
Richard had to force himself to blink.
"I think this Slif thing Kolo keeps talking about lives in that well."
"What is this Slif?"
"The Mriswith mentioned it too." "I don't know. But somehow they use the Slif, whatever it is, to travel to other places. Kolo talks about the enemy sending assassins through the Slif. They were fighting the people in the old world."
Verdine lowered her voice in worry as she leaned toward him.
"You mean to say that you think these wizards could travel from here all the way to this old world and back?"
Richard scratched the itch at the back of his neck.
"I don't know, Verdine. It sounds that way."
Verdine was still staring at him as if she thought he might be about to show further evidence that he was going mad.
"Lord Rawl, how could that be possible?"
"How should I know?"
Richard glanced out the window.
"It's late. We'd better get some sleep."
Verdine yawned again.
"Sounds like a good idea.
Richard shut Kolo's journal and tucked it under an arm. I'm going to read a bit in bed until I fall asleep. Tobias Brogan peered at the Mriswith on the coach and the one inside, and to the others among his columns of men, the sunrise glinting off their armor. He could see all the Mriswith. None were invisible to sneak up on him and listen. His anger boiled at the sight of the side of the Mother Confessor's head in the coach. It enraged him that she was still alive, and that the Creator had forbade him from laying a blade to her. He glanced sideways briefly to make sure Lunetta was close enough to hear him if he spoke softly.
Lunetta, I'm beginning to become very disturbed about this.
She stepped her horse closer as they rode so she could speak with him, but she didn't look over in case any of the Mriswith were watching. The Creator's messengers or not, she didn't like the scaled creatures.
But, Lord General, you said that when the Creator has come to speak with you, he told you that you must do this. You are most honored to be visited by the Creator and to do his work. I think the Creator.
The Mriswith on the coach stood and pointed with a claw as they crested the hill.
See,
it cried out in a sharp hiss, adding a guttural clicking after the word. Brogan lifted his head to see a great city spread out below them, with the glittering sea beyond. In the center of the vast sprawl of buildings, with a golden sunlit river splitting to go around the island atop which it sat, was a huge palace, its towers and roofs sparkling in the sunrise. He had seen cities before, he had seen palaces before, but he had never seen such as this. Despite not wanting to be here, he was awed.
It be beautiful,
Lunetta breathed.
Lunetta,
he whispered.
The Creator visited me again last night. Really, my Lord General, that be wonderful. You be honored to be visited so often of late. The Creator must have great plans for you, my brother.
The things he tells me are becoming more and more unsound.
The Creator? Unsound?
Brogan's gaze slid over to meet his sister's.
Lunetta, I believe there's trouble. I believe the Creator is going insane.
Chapter 45. When the coach stopped, the Mriswith climbed out, leaving the door open. Kaelin glanced out the window to one side and the door to the other. Seeing that the Mriswith were moving off to talk, the two of them were at last alone.
What do you think is going on? She whispered. Where are we?
Addie leaned to the side, looking out the window.
Dear spirits, she whispered in dismay. We be in the heart of enemy territory.
Enemy territory? What are you talking about? Where are we?
Tenemura,
Addie whispered.
That be the palace of the prophets.
The palace of the prophets? Are you sure?
Addie straightened in a seat.
I be sure. I spent time here when I be younger, 50 years ago.
Kaelin stared incredulously.
You went to the old world? You have been to the palace of the prophets?
It be a long time ago, child, and a long story. We do not have time for the story just now, but it be after the blood killed my Pell.
They rode until well after dark, and were on their way long before the sun came up each day. But Kaelin and Addie were at least able to get some sleep in the coach. The men riding horseback got little sleep. A Mriswith, and sometimes Lunetta, always guarded them, and they hadn't been able to speak more than a few words in weeks. The Mriswith didn't care if they slept, but had warned them what would happen if they spoke. Kaelin didn't doubt their word. Over the weeks as they traveled south, the weather had become warmer, and she no longer shivered in the coach. She and Addie pressed together for a little warmth.
I wonder why they brought us here,
Kaelin said. Addie leaned closer.
What I wonder is why they haven't killed us.
Kaelin peeked out the window to see a Mriswith speaking with Brogan and his sister.
Because we are of more value to them alive, obviously.
Value for what?
What do you think?
Who would they want? When I tried to rally the Midlands, they sent that wizard to kill me, and I had to flee as Adendrell slipped into the hands of the Imperial Order. Who is forging the Midlands in opposition to them now?
Addie's eyebrows went up above her white eyes.
Richard.
Kaelin nodded.
That's all I can think of. They had started to take the Midlands and were having success by getting lands to join with them.
Richard changed the rules and disrupted those plans by forcing the lands to surrender to him. Kaelin stared off out the window.
As much as it hurts to admit it, Richard may have done the only thing that has a chance to save the people of the Midlands.
How can we be used to get to Richard?
Addie patted Kaelin's knee.
I know he loves you, Kaelin, but he not be stupid.
Neither is the Imperial Order.
What else could it possibly be, then?
Keelan looked into Addie's white eyes.
Have you ever seen the Sandarians hunt a mountain lion? They tie one of their lambs to a tree, letting it bleat for its mother. Then they sit and wait.
You think we'd be lambs tied to a tree?
Keelan shook her head.
The Imperial Order may be vicious and cruel, but they are not stupid. By now, they will not believe Richard is either. Richard would not trade one life in exchange for the freedom of all, but he has also shown them that he is not afraid to act.
They could be tempting him to think he could effect a rescue without having to surrender anything.
Do you think they'd be right?
Keelan sighed.
What do you think?
Addie's cheeks pushed back in a humorless smirk.
As long as you be alive, he would draw his sword on a lightning storm.
Keelan watched Lunetta climb down from her horse. Mriswith were walking away toward the rear of the columns of crimson-caped men.
Addie, we have to escape, or Richard will come after us.
The Order must be counting on his coming, or we would be dead.
Keelan, I cannot even light a lamp with this cursed collar around my neck.
Keelan sighed in frustration as she looked back out the window and saw the Mriswith moving off into the dark woods. As they walked, they drew their capes around themselves and vanished.
I know. I can't touch my power either.
Then how can we escape?
Keelan watched the sorceress dressed in scraps of different colored cloth as she approached the coach.
If we could turn Lunetta to our side, she could help us.
Addie let out a disagreeable grunt.
She will not turn against her brother.
Addie's brow wrinkled in puzzled thought.
She be an odd one. There be something strange about her.
Strange? Like what?
Addie shook her head.
She touches her power all the time.
All the time?
Yes. A sorceress, or a wizard for that matter, only calls upon their power when they need it. She be different. For some reason, she be touching her power all the time. I have never seen her not clutching it around herself, like her colored cloth patches. It be very odd.
Both of them fell to silence as Lunetta huffed with the effort of climbing into the coach. She dropped into the seat opposite and gave them a pleasant smile. She looked to be in a good mood. Keelan and Addie returned the smile. As the coach lurched ahead, Keelan rearranged herself in the seat, taking the opportunity to check out the window. She didn't see any Mriswith, but that didn't always mean anything.
They be gone, Lunetta said.
What?
Keelan cautiously asked.
The Mriswith be gone.
They all grabbed the handles in the coach as it bounced over ruts.
They told us to go on alone.
To where? Keelan asked, hoping to engage the woman in conversation. Lunetta's eyes brightened beneath her fleshy brow.
The Palace of the Prophets.
She leaned forward excitedly.
It'd be a place full of Streganitia.
Addie scowled.
We not be witches.
Lunetta blinked.
Tobias says we be Streganitia. Tobias be the Lord General. Tobias be a great man.
We not be witches,
Addie repeated.
We be women with the gift, given us by the Creator of all things. Creator would not give us something vile, would he?
Lunetta didn't hesitate for an instant.
Tobias says the Keeper gave us our vile magic. Tobias never be wrong.
Addie smiled at the growing scowl on Lunetta's face.
Of course not, Lunetta. Your brother seems a great and powerful man, just as you say.
Addie rearranged her robes as she crossed a leg.
Do you feel as if you be evil, Lunetta?
Lunetta frowned and thought a moment.
Tobias says I be evil. He tries to help me do good, to make up for the Keeper's taint. I help him root out evil so he can do the Creator's work.
Keelan could tell that Addie was getting nowhere, except perhaps to anger Lunetta, and so changed the subject before things went too far. Lunetta, after all, had control of their collars.
Have you been to the Palace of the Prophets often?
Oh, no,
Lunetta said.
This be the first time. Tobias says it be a house of evil.
Why would he take us there, then?
Keelan asked in an offhanded manner. Lunetta shrugged.
The messengers said we are to go there.
Messengers? Lunetta nodded.
The Mriswith. They be the Creator's messengers. They tell us what to do.
Keelan and Addie sat in stunned silence. At last, Keelan found her voice.
If it's a house of evil, it seems odd that the Creator would want us to go there.
Your brother doesn't seem to trust the Creator's messengers. Keelan had seen Brogan casting scowls in their direction as they walked off into the woods. Lunetta's beady eyes moved between them.
Tobias said I should not talk about them.
Keelan twined her fingers together over a knee.
You don't think the messengers would hurt your brother, do you? I mean, If the palace is a place of evil, as your brother says, the squat woman leaned forward.
I would not let them. Mama said I was always to protect Tobias, because he be more important than me. Tobias be the one.
Why did your mama?
I think we should be quiet now,
Lunetta said in a dangerous tone.